Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Friday, Donald Trump was sworn in as President of the United States. On Saturday, more than 3 million people of all ages joined women's marches in cities across the country to defend women's rights and to challenge the Trump agenda. In many cities, organizers were overwhelmed by the massive numbers. In Washington, D.C., people of all ages packed the march route, making it impossible for people to actually march. In Los Angeles, organizers expected 80,000 people. They say 750,000 showed up. The photos are just incredible. In San Francisco, 100,000 people marched. Activists in Oakland say over 60,000 showed up, more massive numbers. 1,200 in Pacifica, 600 in Palm Springs, 1,700 in Pasadena, 300 in Redding, 25,000 in San Jose, 5,000 in Santa Rosa, 3,000 in Sonoma, and that is just a small part of the California list. An action also took place above the Arctic Circle, where it was 51 below zero, and marches took place around the world from Erbil, Iraq to Accra, Ghana. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about this historic day. What did you make of the Women's March? And if you took part in one of the rallies, we'd love to hear from you. Why did you join? What was your experience like? What matters most to you right now as Donald Trump is signing many executive orders? What needs to happen next? Today, we are joined by three guests. Ruth McFarlane is Director of Development and Community Engagement for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. With over 20 years' experience, Ruth has provided direct services to LGBTQ and other marginalized youth in the Bay Area, including managing a residential program for homeless youth living with HIV. And Ruth spoke at the Women's March here in San Francisco. Hi, Ruth. Thank you for coming in.
Hi. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. We are also joined by Renee Lavelle McKenna. She's an artist and one of the co-leaders of the march in San Francisco. Hi, Renee. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's a privilege. Thanks so much.
Great to have you. And we're joined by Mika White, author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. Mika co-created Occupy Wall Street when he was an editor at Adbusters magazine, and his essays on the future of protests have been published in various publications, including the New York Times. Hi, Mika. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you.
Great to have you. Renee, I want to start off with you. You were one of the co-creators of the march in San Francisco. And, you know, I grew up in California, and there's a Google Doc that's going around about the crowd estimates, and it is so massive. In fact, some of the towns that had marches in California, I have never heard of. I mean, it's just amazing to see. So first off, what's your reaction? I mean, this was just an incredible day.
Well, you know, I can tell you, I just got off a call this morning with all of the march leads from California. We've been meeting weekly via conference call throughout this whole process, and everybody is just blown away. We're just so humbled and inspired by the turnout, and not just the turnout, but the way that people turned out. The enthusiasm, the positivity, the generosity, the kindness and community spirit has just been unbelievable. It was, you know, even for sage protesters, many have said this is the most powerful day of their life.
Wow. I mean, I did interviews in San Francisco, and I met a number of moms and daughters who've never been to a march before. And then, of course, I met a lot of women over 60, some women over 80, who were still carrying the wire hangers saying, why are we still protesting this? Ruth, you spoke at the march in San Francisco. What was your experience like?
Well, it was just amazing. I think it took me a full 24 hours for the wildness in my mind to calm enough that I could really focus on what had happened. I think in San Francisco, we rode the wave of kind of being the last of the rallies and the last of the marches, and we knew what had happened before all day long across the country, and it was just joining in the rain, hand in hand with millions of people around the world, raising, you know, a message of solidarity and broad coalition, and as Renee said, just this incredible spirit of kindness and sisterhood and beautiful men standing with this moment that was about and for and led by women, but also for so many other people. It was extraordinary.
I really also like the fact that the San Francisco March started at 3 because I was glued to my computer screen watching what was happening around the world. Australia and New Zealand had their first marches.
Right.
And then Iraq, Ghana, many countries in Africa
right.
took to the streets. In Denver, 50,000 were expected, but more than 100,000 showed up. Small towns across the country, Utah, I mean, you name it. You name the all 50 states, right? The other thing that I loved were all the homemade signs.
Oh, that was wonderful. The wit and the humor. Just so empowering to see how much humor people are still bringing to this moment. You know, we were, I think, November 9th, we were all blown away, and it was very dark and very hard, and yet here we are rising with this incredible humor and just extraordinary spirit.
Mika, you are one of the co-creators of Occupy Wall Street. We're going to talk about what's next, but first, what is your reaction to these marches? They're now being called the largest marches in U.S. history.
I mean, I think that I represent maybe a little bit of a counter-narrative to, you know, what's going on. I mean, obviously, I'm absolutely thrilled. I think that I believe, and I wrote in my book, and I've been saying for years, I think that women are the next great social movement. I think we're already starting to see that come true. But on the other hand, you know, I as someone who created Occupy Wall Street, who saw this, you know, our movement spread to 82 countries, it was also huge. I just want to caution us and say that now that the women have triggered this amazing release, it's very important that we orient and move as quickly as possible to actually gaining real sovereign power, because these moments come and go. I mean, I don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but in India, in India, they've had marches of 100 million people in the streets. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but it's true, 100 million people. So it's not about crowd size. It's about what you use these crowds to achieve. And that's the big question. And I think that's what Occupy was unable to do. We weren't able to achieve what we set out to do. And I think the Women's March has to really very quickly orient towards achieving what it wants to achieve.
Well, we'll get to that. But just to feel a little bit of joy for a few more minutes, because we all need it, right? But Micah, the thing that really struck me, I've done so many interviews on the streets, but I met so many people who came out for the very first time. Can you talk about the significance of that? And I also asked them, how do you plan to stay engaged? And some people were a little confused about that. They weren't really sure. And I have to say, I really wish from the speakers that I heard more calls to action. But what are your thoughts about just the people who took to the streets on Saturday for the first time ever?
Yeah, I mean, that's what's amazing. I mean, what we're witnessing, right, since the birth of Occupy through Black Lives Matter and now the Women's March, what we're seeing is that we are having the most frequent and largest protests in human history. That is the large-scale protest is like the signature of our era now. And so there's like, I mean, it'd be fascinating to see what a survey of what percentage of the American population has been to at least one protest in the last 10 years. I mean, it's probably very, very high, and it continues to grow. So I think that's a really good sign. But I do think that the thing is that, you know, these protests at a certain point cease being protests, and they start to be just performance. And that, I think, is really something that we need to think about. I do think it's something to celebrate that everyone went, and it's great. But at the same time, I think we do need a kind of like revolutionary realism, a little bit of a harder look, you know. And and I think that people in the streets want that. They want this to be the last protest. Let's put it this way: wouldn't it be great if the Women's March was the last protest because we actually won, instead of like, you know, another Occupy or another Black Lives Matter or another milestone in the great history of large-scale protests?
Renee, what are your thoughts about that? Mika says that we need to have action here so the Women's March doesn't turn into Occupy.
I'm so glad Mika's here, and I really welcome his excuse me, his experience. Experience is incredibly important going forward. You know, I've been meditating on that for the last 48 hours or however many hours it's been since I finally got to sleep on Saturday night. And you know, I feel like this is a grassroots movement, and that's where this needs to go back. I really want to call people to gather together in diverse community groups. We're going to help to organize through the massive volunteer list that we have, to have people, I would like to call people to meet once a week, once every other week, once a month at the minimum. with a group of people, of at least 5 people, as many as 20, and share a meal, share your diverse cultures, share the news that's happening, get clear on the disinformation that's happening, and get clear on what's true, and decide what the next steps that your community group wants to take. And we're going to hopefully organize those community groups in larger forums, because the people need to get together. We need to connect. You know, there was a 17-year-old boy who connected with our march leader down in San Jose, who I think you're going to talk to in a little while. And he said that the march saved his life, that he's gay, and he felt so marginalized and so hopeless that he was considering taking his life. And being at that march on Saturday, he realized he wasn't alone. And people need to know, not only are we not alone, but we can do so much together. But we need to get together. We need to put our bodies where our beliefs are, as Gloria Steinem said the other day. We need to show up and not just press send. We need to get together and talk with each other and take action together.
Well, that's an incredible story about that young boy. And Jenny Bradanini, who is one of the leaders in San Jose, is going to join us in about 10 minutes to tell us more about that incredible story. I'm sure you have some stories about that, right, Ruth?
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I think it's so important for us to remember that words have consequences. And things are moving so quickly with the Trump administration, but we cannot forget the horrific things he said that really affected young people, brown people, LGBTQ people, women. I mean, so many people, especially young people.
Yeah, youth. I mean, when we sort of, I guess there's one thing I just want to piggyback on what was being said. I think this is absolutely important, as Renee said, that this is a grassroots moment. But there is a call to action for leaders across existing social justice movements in this country to work together. You know, the work isn't just, you know, I think it's fine to say this is a beginning. It's absolutely a cresting of another wave. But there is a social justice work that has been done in this country for decades. And there are leaders that have been doing this work for a long time. And we have now been called to action ourselves to work together and to work in new ways. One of the things we saw in the LGBT movement immediately upon the election of Trump, was this a ripple of fear across youth, trans youth in particular, deep, deep concern and a terrible impact there. We saw extreme concern and anxiety amongst immigrants, especially people seeking asylum. We have at NCLR a number of transgender asylees that we represent and, you know, just obviously a great deal of concern, DACA as well, you know, Dreamers, all of this. These are the people that are in the front lines. And yes, immediately the rhetoric, even before the election, the rhetoric of the campaign and what Trump is willing to say and tweet puts lives in danger.
And last week we did an entire series about President Obama's legacy and what he is leaving for Donald Trump. And we did a whole show on immigration, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. And Ruth, what do you think about, Mika wrote a piece in The Guardian last week called "Without a Path from Protest to Power, the Women's March Will End Up Like Occupy." And he says that raising awareness and getting media attention is never enough. Neither brings the people closer to sovereign power. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's a really, really important point. I also think that these crests of the wave, every time the wave crests, it includes more people. That means it includes more voices. It includes more stories. It causes us to have a greater understanding of what the need actually is, and it opens up an opportunity for new leadership. One of the things we saw on Saturday was the voices of women of color in the forefront. I saw a sign that I absolutely love, and it just said, "For God's sake, listen to black women." You know, so that's also very, very important. But I think it's right. We have to also have a strategy. We have to have a plan. When we're talking about a multi-sector, multi-movement moment like this, that strategy is extraordinarily complex.
Right. And the indigenous women had a huge section at the march in Washington, D.C. A lot of people from Standing Rock went to D.C. To take to the streets.
Right. I mean, again, so we see that leaders who have there at Standing Rock, like what an extraordinary movement they have built. They have plans. They have strategies. This isn't starting from scratch. It's a matter of us getting together now and sharing those and understanding the complexity. And then at the grassroots level, really educating people on what does it look like when our government, when our system, our way of life, our commitment to equality to inclusion to democracy begins to be dismantled, what will that look like? What should we be looking for? What can we do to prevent those moves, these moves against agencies, these moves on administrative law, them, you know, attacking policies? These are sort of esoteric lawyerly things, but the people need to understand how our government actually works, mm-hmm. what it will look like when they start removing bricks from the wall, what we do to stop that, and then when those bricks do get removed, how do we stand in the gap, right?
Ruth McFarlane is Director of Development and Community Engagement with the National Center for Lesbian Rights. She has been working on a number of issues for over 20 years, including providing direct services to LGBTQ and other marginalized youth in the Bay Area, and she spoke at the Women's March in San Francisco. Renee Lavelle McKenna is an artist who is one of the co-creators of the March in San Francisco. And Micah White is author of The End of Protest, a new playbook for revolution. Micah co-created Occupy Wall Street when he was an editor at Adbusters, and I hope you can check out his piece in The Guardian, Without a Path from Protest to Power, the Women's March Will End Up Like Occupy. And we'd love to hear from you. If you took to the streets on Saturday, what was your experience like? What matters most to you right now as Donald Trump is starting to sign executive actions? It's hard to keep up with things because they're moving so quickly. What needs to happen next? How do we keep this momentum going? And what actions are you planning to take? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page or Twitter. And before we take calls, Micah, I mean, we could have, I think we should have actually an entire hour conversation about what happened to Occupy. But since you wrote a book about protest, you write extensively about these issues, what is at the top of your list? What really happened with Occupy? What went wrong?
Yeah, that's a really excellent question. That's what every activist and every person needs to be thinking about right now. So basically what happened is that Occupy Wall Street was the consummation. It was the realization of a story that activists have been telling ourselves about how social change happens. The story goes something like, if you can get enough people into the streets, largely nonviolent, you know, largely unified behind a single demand, well, then our elected representatives will have to listen to us. And with Occupy, we combined that with another idea, which was, if we can have these general assemblies, this purer form of democracy, then we'll manifest some sort of sovereignty. I mean, this goes, I think it's really important for activists to think about this concept of sovereignty. The reason why we march in the streets in the abstract level is we're trying to manifest some sort of sovereignty greater than our elected representatives. And really, what I'm trying to get across is that doesn't work, okay? We know that doesn't work because of the 2003 anti-war marches, where they were also, if 2003, February 15th, they were also on every single continent. There was also millions of people in the streets across America. And the demand was even more clear. It was no to the war. And the war happened anyway. And since that point, our Western governments have realized that street protests actually can be ignored, and that street protests actually function to legitimize the government. Because they are not a threat, they actually function to convince people that our democracy is functioning. And I think that it's so the core idea here is that if activists want to gain political power, there's only two ways to do it. They can use social protest to win elections, or they can use social protest to win wars. That's it. Social protest alone is not enough. You can either use it in conjunction with elections or with wars. That was the lesson of Occupy Wall Street. That lesson, Black Lives Matter did not learn that lesson, and that's why Black Lives Matter has basically disappeared after one of their, you know, they had two different cop shootings after their marches. And this is the lesson that now is being tossed onto the Women's March. Can the Women's March turn into a force that is able to lead women into winning elections across the world? If not, it's over. That's it. Okay? That's basically where we stand as activists. And we're seeing it develop in Europe, and we can talk more about it. But that's the essential challenge that we face right now as activists.
I'm sure a lot of people here in the Bay Area would say Black Lives Matter did not disappear.
Well,
Why would you say that, Micah?
I would say that because you have to, I mean, it's the same right now today. People say also that Occupy Wall Street didn't disappear. I think what I'm trying to get at is that obviously nothing ever really ends. You know, they struggle onward. But I think that we do have to acknowledge that after basically people got dissatisfied with the effectiveness of marches, there was two different episodes where Black Lives Matter sympathizers killed police officers, first in Dallas. Okay. And so, definitely since that point, the movement hasn't ended, but it's like Occupy Wall Street. Once we lost the encampment, once people stopped believing in the efficacy of our encampments, the movement basically disappeared. I mean, it still exists, but it basically is gone. I think the same with Black Lives Matter. Once people stopped believing in the efficacy of blocking traffic, being disruptive as a way to get police to stop killing Black people, the movement basically died down. Once female marchers stopped believing in the efficacy of the proposals being put forward, such as large-scale marches or sending postcards, I saw that being the next proposal. Once they stop believing in that, the movement will also dissipate. So it's very important to put forward proposals that will actually work and that people can actually believe in. And that is to gain political power through elections or through winning wars.
Mika, I think it's important. I think the points you're making are important, but I think it's also important to point out that the Black Lives Matter movement is much broader than what happens in the streets, and that power, they've drawn a lot of power by creating coalitions at a local level. There's been a lot that's gotten done at the community level in areas in the South, in particular, in places where this type of coming together is much harder to do. And that's been done, yes, through the media and through, you know, capturing the media through these large street protests. But there have been many, many, many much smaller actions taken on school campuses in small towns and across far-flung kind of rural areas that have been very, very powerful. The other thing I think is important that we think about right now is to talk about the media and the press and the moment that the press is in right now. Where will they focus their attention, and how can we as grassroots movements, and just the cresting of the wave? Again, the Women's March is a moment where many, many movements came together. It isn't just, you know, Occupy is much more focused on a particular set of economic issues. The Black Lives Matter movement is, again, focused on a particular set of issues. The Women's March was very different in that it was a much, much broader angle lens that was held up to social justice. And so I think there is a moment for us to engage the media and the press, which at this point is in a moment of heated sort of pitched battle with our new administration. How can we sort of take this moment and make it something new? And I don't think making these sort of blanket comparisons to Occupy or Black Lives Matter are necessarily capturing the whole picture.
Micah, what do you think?
No, of course. This is a really good discussion to have. Of course, it's extremely nuanced, but I just would like to point out, as a revolutionary realist over here, look at it, okay? Black Lives Matter lasted, okay, it's ongoing, at least 3 years. Donald Trump's campaign was only 18 months long. So it took Donald Trump just 18 months to go from zero to being the president. Black Lives Matter, after 3 years, has not gained political power. Occupy Wall Street, after 5 years, has not gained political power. So what I'm trying to say is that there are movements in Europe right now, social movements, that are gaining political power. In Spain, they have Podemos. In Iceland, they have the Pirate Party. In Italy, they have the Five Star Movement. American activists are obsessed with this notion that we are somehow winning when we're actually losing. I'll tell you who's winning right now. Donald Trump is winning, okay? But we can beat Donald Trump. We can build something like a Podemos or a Five Star Movement. We can do that, and we know we can do that because American activists are extremely good at mobilizing large numbers of people and getting them to do synchronized behaviors. So now it's a question of transforming what we consider protest. We need to start thinking of protest as basically building social movements that hack and win elections. That's the next challenge. And until we get there, we're going to constantly be celebrating, yeah, I mean, I get it. Occupy was a good thing. Black Lives Matter is a good thing. These are all good things. But who is the president right now? Okay? I mean, Donald Trump, okay? And it only took him 18 months. And he didn't even spend as much as Hillary Clinton. So this is a real wake-up call. We should be really kind of realizing that we could become the president. Women's March could become the president. Black Lives Matter could become the president. Occupy could become the president. That's the reality. So we need to orient towards doing that.
And Renee, before we let you go, what are your thoughts about that? How do you – I mean, again, Micah says, without a clear path from march to power, the protest is destined to be an ineffective feel-good spectacle. And I remember covering Occupy in San Francisco, and one of the supervisors wanted to speak, and they said, you know what? We're not taking part in politics. We're not telling people to vote. We're not advocating voting, and we don't want the supervisor to speak with us. Obviously, it's different for the Women's March, but what are your thoughts about this? Because, you know, a lot of people said we're not going to take part in this system, a lot of people who were involved in Occupy.
So I think, for myself, I'm a therapist, and that's the lens that I see things through. And politics is indicative of culture. And I personally think that Black Lives Matter and Occupy have had an effect. Now, maybe they aren't the president, but certainly people who weren't aware are aware in ways that they've never been aware before. And The Women's March is a woman-led movement, I think, as opposed to a movement just about women's rights. So, you know, Ruth really aptly talked about what this is about. It's a much broader lens, which some might see as diluted. I don't. I think this is about really bringing, for myself, the divine feminine, like this feminine aspect of connection and community into politics, into our daily lives, into our culture in a way that it hasn't been before. And I think it's going to create tremendous change in individual people's lives, and that becomes a political reality.
Renee Lavelle McKenna is an artist and one of the co-leaders of the March in San Francisco. Renee, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And sticking with us for the rest of the hour is Ruth McFarlane, Director of Development and Community Engagement for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and Micah White, author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution, co-creator of Occupy Wall Street, and he's got a piece in The Guardian called Without a Path from Protest to Power, the Women's March Will End Up Like Occupy. So what do you think? What is the path from protest to power? This is your call. We'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in this conversation. You could call us on the telephone, but the phone lines are completely filled up. You may still send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You may send us a message to our website, to yourcallradio.org, the website. You can also tweet us at yourcallradio. If the line opens up, you may call us at 866-798-8255. Number again is 866-798-8255.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with Jane McAlevey about her new book, Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Labor union members make up only 11% of American workers, and Jane McAlevey argues that meaningful change can only happen with organizing that puts ordinary people at the center of their own struggle. So what are the most effective strategies? We'll also ask Jane about what she thinks about the Women's March and what it will take to really create a path from protest to power. I hope you can join us tomorrow. Today, we are talking about Saturday's women's marches that took place around the country and around the globe. It was really incredible to see. More than 3 million people took to the streets in so many cities across the country. In fact, so many in California. I grew up in California, and I've never heard of some of these cities. Marches also took place in Erbil, Iraq, in Ghana, in the Arctic, where it was 50 below zero. In San Francisco, over 100,000 people marched. In Oakland, over 60,000. In San Jose, 25,000. If you took place in an action, what was your experience like? What really matters most to you right now? And what needs to happen next? Micah White is author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. He's co-creator of Occupy Wall Street. He wrote a piece for The Guardian called Without a Path from Protest to Power, the Women's March Will End Up Like Occupy. Ruth McFarlane is director of development and community engagement for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and she was one of the speakers at the march in San Francisco. And we've got full lines, so let's kick it off with Anne in Berkeley. Hi, Anne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Oh, I'm so excited to talk to you. I have a great idea, I think, for what I need to go from marching to power. We need, I think, a website, a national website with a catchy name like the Vote 'Em Out website, that would be state by state who exactly in our state is voting in opposition to our values, so that you could go in, whether you're from Delaware or Oklahoma or Maine. You could go in, click on the website, see your state and who has voted, which of the representatives, which of the senators have voted exactly in opposition to what we stand for. And if we had a great name for it, like the Vote 'Em Out website or the Freedom website, then when we march, we could carry placards that say, vote out so-and-so, John Smith, Michael Brown, vote them out. And I think it would give us a great path to power if everybody in the country knew exactly which of their state representatives or congresspeople are voting in opposition to what we stand for, because we got to get them out of there.
Well, thank you so much, Anne. That's a good idea. In fact, I was trying to find one website where I can learn about legislation that has been introduced at the federal level, and it's hard to even find that. I mean, you have to do really deep digging and research to figure out what's really going on in Sacramento and in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I know that's definitely true. And CLR is trying to get, you know, we try to get postings up as quickly as we can about what's going on for LGBT people, but it is way more complicated than that right now. And so staying educated is tough.
And I want to ask you quickly, Ruth, over the weekend when Donald Trump became president, a number of issues disappeared from whitehouse.gov, including any reference to LGBTQ issues. A lot of people say that there's just a transition happening. Do you know what's really going on?
Well, what we know is that the policies, including LGBT policies, also policies about climate change, did come down when they transitioned.
And disabilities.
Yep, when they transitioned the website for the White House, they brought those down. And one narrative there as well. They were just transitioning many things. You know, the POTUS Twitter feed also went to Donald Trump, but. You know, I think there's a lot more to that. It's very significant that those policies were dropped. They didn't have to come down.
Right. Well, we'll keep track of this because I think this is really important. Well, thank you for calling in, Anne, and we'll be on the lookout for something like that, and we'll let you know if we find it. Let's go next to Babette in San Francisco. Hi, Babette. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much. I'm very excited about what I'm seeing, and thanks for covering it so well. And what I wanted to add was that I got to go with my 17-year-old. She was 3 years old in the Iraq War March. So it was really wonderful to be able to be there with my daughter, with the next generation, for which we have to fight. And my main concern, and her concern, was that a lot of the sloganeering is so negative. It's so anti this, anti that, but there's not a pro this, pro that in the chants that go on. And I know it's just a march.
Babette, I'm sorry. I think we're losing your line. Babette was just saying that there was some negative chanting. I didn't hear that at all at the San Francisco rally, and I thought a lot of the signs were very pro and just funny, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, with a march this big, anything can happen.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure. I mean, I.
But for children, obviously, you don't want your child to hear F Trump on the street, right?
Fair enough.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for calling in, Babette. I think we're having some problems with our phone lines. Micah, let's go back to you. I want to talk to you about, you know, there's so much to talk about in terms of how to maintain this power and then a path to power. Yesterday was the 44th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. And so many women and girls are losing their rights across the country. And this is happening under Democrats. Democrats are losing to some of the most extreme Republicans we have ever seen. What are your thoughts about that aspect of all of this? That in many cases, Democrats are given a pass for doing things that people would be out on the streets raising hell about if Republicans did them. I mean, you know, Democrats lost across the country. It wasn't just Hillary Clinton who lost the Electoral College, but it was Dems across the country that lost races at the state houses and also in Congress.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we have to realize is that there is basically a global geopolitical shift going on right now. It's like an earthquake, and it's shifting alliances. All of a sudden now America's friends with Putin and people are confused and we're pushing away from China and all this kind of stuff. And now China's going to Davos and saying, we're the upholders of free trade and all this kind of. So the world is undergoing a dramatic shift, and that shift is impacting America. And I think that what's happening right now is the reason why the Dems ultimately lost is because the whole world is being taken over by a wave of populism, an anti-establishment populism. And there's two different visions of that populism emerging. There's a kind of authoritarian, strong-arm populism, which is Donald Trump, Putin, you know, the new president in the Philippines who's killing drug dealers. And then there's a kind of horizontal, decentralized, democratic populism that's like, you know, Podemos in Spain or the Five Star Movement in Italy. Right now in America, we don't have that anti-establishment, pro-democracy populism. All we have is a kind of Donald Trump authoritarian populism. And I think that that's really what's happening. And so if you're in, you know, basically people are being drawn into this new ideology of populism in America that they're seeing globally, and they only have one option, which is Donald Trump. And until the left, until Democrats are able to kind of create, basically, this is the opportunity here. We can create a women's party, a global women's party that represents a kind of populism, but a democratic populism. Until we have that, until that exists, I think that you know, the old establishment is going to continue to lose. I mean, I think that really we should be happy. Okay, Donald Trump's horrible, and I don't like him, but we should be happy that he won, because it proves that we could do that too. It proves that an anti-establishment candidate can win the presidency. And that's really good news if you are interested in launching a women's political party in America, because it actually means that you might actually pull it off. I mean, that's amazing. You know, 4 years ago, that didn't seem possible. So that's where we need to be going, is we need to basically ignore the left-right and just create a democratic populism that can win elections in multiple countries.
Ruth, what are your thoughts on that?
That sounds great. I think that sounds amazing. I mean, if we can do that. The one thing that sort of is echoing in my mind is that I don't want people who marched for the first time in 20 years or marched for the first time in their life to feel like the only thing they can do is vote right now. Because there is so much else that you can do. Raising up a populist movement is about relationship. And so folks can get in conversation in their communities. It may sound passive, it may sound like nothing, but frankly, to stand up in your church, if your church is a conservative church, and say, hey, I may be 17 years old, but I support the lesbian and gay and bisexual and transgender kids in my school. To go to Thanksgiving dinner, I have to say, I heard so many people say, oh my God, I'm going home for Thanksgiving. We're not going to talk about the election because it'll start a fight. Well, go home and start a fight. Go home and say something. It's okay to put your relationship with your brother or your father or whoever on the line right now. That's how you raise up a populist movement.
Well, and Jane McAlevey, who's going to be on tomorrow, says organizing in churches is so, so important.
Absolutely. Well, we got it. The other thing that's, you know, a danger here, and it's so easy for us, we're in San Francisco, we're in the Bay Area, we're in New York, D.C., whatever, on the coasts, it is so easy for us to look at the big establishment, the institutions, to talk about elections. In the middle of the country, they're talking about church. Mm-hmm. They're talking about school. They're talking about who they're going to see in the grocery line that they also have to deal with at work, right? And those conversations look really different. And those of us who know how to have conversations with conservatives, with people who consider themselves not political, we're powerful right now if we can find our voices.
And 90 million people did not vote in this last election. 90 million people.
We've got to see that change.
If you had a tiny percentage of those people vote, we could live in a different country, really.
Right.
I mean, because what's happening on the ground in places like Texas, where young women are being flown out of Texas to get abortions if they can't get approval from a judge because they can't tell their parents, they're being flown out of the state.
It's incredible, and people need to know about that. I don't think people know.
Ruth McFarlane is Director of Development and Community Engagement for the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and she spoke at the Women's March in San Francisco. I have to say, these marches got nonstop coverage on the cable channels over the weekend, but you hardly got any substance about why people were on the streets, hardly any talk at all about attacks on abortion and reproductive rights. Micah White is author of The End of Protest and co-creator of Occupy Wall Street. Now I would like to welcome Jenny Brandonini to the show. Jenny is co-leader of the Women's March, which took place in San Jose. Hi, Jenny. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
I read that 25,000 people showed up in San Jose.
Actually, that's a low estimate. Wow. We had a number come in today at closer to 40,000.
40,000 in San Jose.
Yeah, isn't that great?
That is amazing. Jenny, what struck you about the march, the people you met, the things you heard in San Jose?
It was out of our wildest dreams that it would be so peaceful and so positive. I know that Renee told you a story about a 17-year-old, an email that I received, and it was just one little antidote, but I know that that happened in so many moments across these marches where people felt hopeful again for the first time and coming together and feeling positive, like we really can make a difference. We're little, but when we come together, we're big. We can do this. We can make a difference. And just the feeling, the energy of that hope, If I could bottle that and just keep that going, we wouldn't have any worries. It's just the question is moving it forward and keeping it going now and how we're going to do that.
Right. And Jenny, before we talk about that, just quickly, you have a story to tell, which Renee told us earlier, but it's about a young boy, a gay boy, who called you or wrote you and said, you know, talked about the significance of the march in his life.
Yeah. He was very desperate, and he was not even going to attend the march, not comfortable in his own skin and feeling very alone and dark in a dark place, and came out. And for the first time, he said since the election and even before that he felt hope, that he felt proud of who he was. And he said that this saved him. And I, the power of that, you know, the one voice that I communicate with him, I know resonates through not just him, but through so many people. And, you know, think of the magnitude of that. If we saved him, think of how many other people there are in their stories that have the same situation. So it's so important that we keep this open, keep the communication open, and making sure that people feel welcome, feel hopeful, mm-hmm. and know what to do going forward and where to go.
So important. I wanted to ask you also about a piece that Micah wrote in The Guardian, "Without a Path from Protest to Power, the Women's March Will End Up Like Occupy." I know this is all still sinking in for all of you, but what are your thoughts about creating a path from protest to power?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways to do that. I mean, we have political organizations. I attended a call last night that was put together. It's called an emergency training call, and it was hosted by Move On, Indivisible, and the Working Family Parties. And I encourage anyone to go Google that. They recorded it, and it was, you know, a basic 101 what to do next, like how to contact your senator or your Congress. Many people don't know how to do that, are very intimidated by that. And the Invisible Guide, I think we've mentioned here a few different times now, is also another way to do that. At the national level, with the Women's March, they put out 10 for 10. And again, their first thing is a postcard to send out to their congressmen, I think, or senators. And in California, we're in a different situation. We're more thanking them for doing the good work. And so it's a different maybe tone to that. But there, as this is all spinning and baking and coming forward, there's more and more ways. What we were telling people is in San Jose, we had something called a call to action alley, which was 38 organizations, nonprofit, and community groups that had their information on how to get involved. And so we encourage people to get the information and connect with each other and self-organize as well.
And we've been mentioning the Indivisible Guide a few times. This is a guide that was written by former congressional staffers, which reveals what they call best practices for making Congress listen. And you can find this at indivisibleguide.com. And I also just wanted to mention that in California, Democrats have a supermajority, which means they can raise taxes or pass legislation without one Republican vote. But a lot of people say that the lobbyists are now moving to the moderate Democrats, so there is pressure to be put on Democrats if there's a piece of legislation that you care about, because it now will be the progressives versus the moderates. And Micah, I wanted to read an email that we just got for you from Erin, who says, what's important right now is what is the next step? She says, I'm hearing a lot of great, hopeful stuff, but I'm feeling isolated and unsure where to connect with others. I was at the march in Oakland. I signed a few clipboards, but I don't know what to do next, and I don't want to put all the work on the group circulating these boards. I've liked a few groups on Facebook. I'm not blaming anyone for not providing me with more info, but what next? I don't want this momentum to be wasted.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, I want to say something which is going to be extremely controversial for the contemporary activist paradigm, but there's been a study that shows that activism is not more effective when you work in coalition with others. I'm saying this to Erin because she's an isolated activist. I have been an isolated activist my entire life. I'm not isolated in a bad way, but independent, I would say. And so what I would say to Erin is, what you have to do is you have to tap into your revolutionary intuition. Absolutely the most important thing to do right now is I've tried to call for people to gather on February 4th with their friends. What I would do if I were an individual activist and I'm inspired and I want to move forward is I would bring your friends over to your house on February 4th or whatever day, actually, and just sit down and start talking about what's happening with Spain's Podemos, five-star movement in Italy, the Pirate Party in Iceland, and let's think about concretely, well, how do we start moving forward to build a social movement that can win elections in America? Now, I'll tell you what we'd have to do in a very literal sense is the one barrier of entry is signature gathering, okay? Signature gathering needs to be taken up as a new form of political protest. The Green Party wasn't even able to get onto all 50 state ballots. That's ridiculous.
Hmm.
So if we had a social movement, we had 3 million people in the streets yesterday, over this weekend. You only need to collect 1 million signatures to get on all 50 state ballots. So we need people like Aaron and other people to start imagining, okay, how am I actually going to build a women's party that's going to take power at the local level in my community? First step, what are the positions that are going to be available and when? Some communities have elections in 2017. Most communities are going to have elections in 2018. What do we need to do to get on the ballot? This is what I'm saying is, like, basically you have to just don't coalition. Just focus on this problem of winning elections.
Ruth, what are your thoughts about that, winning elections? And can you address, you know, what happened with Occupy? So many people did not want to get involved in the mm-hmm. system. No voter outreach, that's not allowed here. I heard that from a lot of people in San Francisco. So what are your thoughts on that?
No, I think it's absolutely important that we do voter outreach and that people are activated around participating in elections. I think my concern is, especially for a caller like Aaron, that, you know, for those people who are brand new to this, will they be able to bring a group to their home and to sort of self-study and figure stuff out? Do they have to begin from scratch? Or in the Bay Area, are there numerous community organizations and nonprofits and people doing things that, you know, if you did sign several clipboards and if you're on several Facebook pages and such, go to an event. Join in some, you know, do some phone calls with a group of people. Join a phone bank. Go do that. Start somewhere. Get involved in the political system in a way that maybe you haven't before and start learning about how it works. You will find then, you know, a group of people to march with metaphorically. Forward. I do think it's really, really overwhelming for folks to think, oh, I'm here, I'm an activist in isolation and I have to know what to do.
Right.
That's great if you are in fact an activist, but many, many people that came out over the weekend don't see themselves that way. This is the first time they've done this, or it's the first time in a long time. And so it's really, I don't want to toss aside the word coalition in case people understand that as being in community, which I'm sure Mika sees as something a little different than coalition in the way that he's using the word. But I think folks blur those words together. And so do be in community. You know, do have folks to your home or go to somebody's house, or get out there to a community organization that's doing it already and start learning some things.
Jenny, what would you add?
I would echo that. And I've been telling people that have been contacting me, you went to a sign-making party. There's a coalition right there. It doesn't have to be this direct action when we're talking about certain legislation. Just get together as a community and start talking about it. And we don't have to recreate the wheel. Like the Indivisible Guide helps you do that. Moving on, these organizations, the Working Family Group, the womensmarch.com 100 actions, which is the 10 and 10, make it really easy for you to be involved.
And Micah, we have a question on Facebook from Courtney. She says, can you talk about the attributes of the movements in Europe that are gaining ground?
Yeah, I mean, I think that basically what the first challenge that social movements have to solve is how to make complex decisions together as a movement. So right now in America, we actually can't do that. You know, like Occupy couldn't come up with one demand. You know, we fall back onto these leadership models. So one thing I'm really inspired by is the Five Star Movement in Italy, is where one of the things that defines who they are is that they actually have a vetting process. So you have to apply to be part of the movement. They check out who you are. They let you in. And then after that, all of the candidates that run for office, they have to basically audition to the movement. And the movement votes on them and says, okay, we want you to run for mayor here and here. And then that person gains power. But the movement still maintains decision-making power over what kind of things that wants those candidates to do. That's the core thing that we're trying to get across, and this is why ultimately I'm critical of Bernie Sanders and the Our Revolution concept. What we're trying to get to is, imagine a women's movement that didn't just give power away to the candidate that they elected, but instead somehow maintained power over that candidate to the point of actually deciding, oh, this candidate, you know, wants to do X. Well, the movement actually wants them to do something else. So now they have to do the something else. So I think that what the movements in Europe are solving is this question of, well, how do we make complex decisions together as a movement? How do we maintain control over the people that we elect? And how do we kind of create a filter to define who is us and who is not us. That's one of the things that really destroyed Occupy. Is we could never say, oh, that guy over there who's obviously a police informant, like, he's not part of Occupy, because he could just raise his hand and say, well, yes, I am. I'm part of Occupy. Anyone who says they're part of Occupy is part of Occupy. There was no sort of filtering mechanism. So those are the three things. That's why the way to think about it conceptually is it's merging a movement, which is amorphous and decentralized, with a party, which is more centralized and more able to make decisions and put forward leaders and stuff like this. So that's, you know, the main thing to do is, I would just, as an activist, I would start researching Podemos, Five Star Movement, Pirate Party, reading about what they're doing, reading about the failures. I mean, talk to Europeans, they're also skeptical. It's not like it's a golden ticket. There's challenges once you get there, but it is the way forward.
And we don't have time for any more callers. We have to continue doing shows about this because we're slammed with calls and emails. Kate writes in, there's a concrete action you can take today. Senator Dianne Feinstein is requesting that anyone who marched in California or D.C. send 3 to 4 sentences about why you marched. She'll review them and incorporate the sentiments into her opening statement before the Senate Judiciary Committee tomorrow. This is not a cut and paste meme. This is a direct request I just received from her chief of staff, who I met with last week. You can email Sean_Elsberned. Okay, it's Sean_ELSBERND at Feinstein, FEINSTIN.senate.gov. Sean_Elsberned at Feinstein.senate.gov. And she'll bring this to the Senate Judiciary Committee tomorrow. Thank you for that, Kate. Jenny, final thoughts from you?
We also have that information on our social media pages, and we're putting it on our website too. So if people missed that, they can find that at the Women's March BayArea.org page.
Okay, great. Thank you for that. And Ruth, final thoughts from you?
No, it's just such a pleasure to do this. The other piece of this is that, as I said earlier, there are a lot of organizations involved, and so I'm going to go back to the leadership, you know, that I'm involved with in the LGBTQ space, and we need to talk about what we're going to do working with other movements that have all, you know, risen up together and how we can collaborate.
Ruth McFarlane is Director of Development and Community Engagement for the National Center for Lesbian Rights. We've also been joined by Jenny Brandonini, leader of the Women's March in San Jose, and Mika White, author of The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution, co-creator of Occupy Wall Street, and be sure to check out his piece in The Guardian, Without a Path from Protest to Power, the Women's March Will End Up Like Occupy. Ruth, Jenny, and Mika, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
you so much. And I just got a message from a listener who said, my numbers for San Francisco were low. The new crowd estimates in San Francisco, well over 220,000, and Oakland, well over 90,000. The low numbers for marchers across the country, 3.3 million, and the high numbers, 4.6 million. Incredible. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation with Jane McAlevey about her new book, Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Labor union members make up only 11% of American workers, and Jane McAlevey argues that meaningful change can only happen with organizing that puts ordinary people at the center of their own struggle. So what are the most effective strategies to create a vibrant labor movement? I hope you can join us tomorrow at 10 a.m. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Thanks for joining us.